Well, I guess we can go ahead and get started. My name's Chris Tidwell, as an introduction first off. I am the co-host on America Unchained, a podcast with Richard Winfield as well, who we have today. He is a candidate for the U.S. Senate in the Georgia special election against Kelly Loeffler. He's also a professor of philosophy at the University of Georgia and author of 22 books, no less, discussing philosophy, politics, art, and most recently, his one, Democracy Unchained, is a book aimed at healing our American democracy with an agenda of a social bill of rights, which includes a job guarantee, which will also be the main focus of today's discussion. Given that we have Professor Pavlina Cherneva, a professor and economist at Bard College, also a scholar at the Levy Institute in New York. Her recent book, which has gained a lot of traction and acclaim, is The Case for a Job Guarantee. That's the name. And it argues for exactly that, that is both possible and important to provide a voluntary employment for all those who may need a job. And it is not just a fantasy, but a necessity to reduce employment down to 0%, which in the past might've seemed a bit less connective to the American people today, but with 30 million out of work at home, given the mishandling of the coronavirus pandemic, I'm sure a lot of people are beginning to see the light on this issue in particular. But given this sort of coalescence of ideas, we might be able to see that many will debate this plan for a or case for a job guarantee under the guise of unemployment not only being natural and unavoidable, but even desirable at a certain rate that supposedly keeps inflation in check. And Professor Cherneva, I was wondering if you could maybe address these views and simply what's wrong with them.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me, Richard, and thank you, Chris, for moderating. I'm very pleased to be here because I think Richard's framework for thinking about these economic issues is crucial. It's very important that we need to interrogate the question, what is economic justice? You know, what does it mean to provide the very basic preconditions for economic security? And the right to a decent and remunerative job always comes up in conversations, in national and international conversation that we have had for easily over 100 years. And, you know, I want to start from looking at the question backwards, talking about unemployment. Why have we accepted unemployment as such a perennial problem, tacitly? Or explicitly. And so there are a couple of problems. One is sort of the layperson perception that, you know, if you just ask, you know, somebody, you know, do you think unemployment is, you know, is something that that can be avoided? You know, most folks probably will say that, you know, it's a pretty normal thing to have unemployment. But the real trouble, I think, comes from the economic profession that canonizes unemployment as natural. And we have this notion in economics of the natural unemployment rate that somehow if you leave the economy on its own devices, there will be so many millions that will be left out of work. And then what we do in economics is then we jump through a lot of hoops to come up with all sorts of different definitions of what is full employment. And we give various numbers, you know, 10% unemployment is full employment, 5% is natural unemployment, you know, 3%, we can't agree. But there is this tacit acceptance that there will be, you know, millions of people who are out of work that will be naturally unemployed, and worse, that that might be actually a requirement for economic stability. So, you know, folks who might be paying attention to the discussions of the so-called NIRU, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. This is basically a concept that says that if unemployment falls below a certain level, terrible things might happen. Prices might go up, inflation might increase. And so in fact, policymakers like the Fed have to keep a watchful eye and ensure that unemployment doesn't fall below this so-called natural rate. And this is a problem, you know, and this is, I really want to challenge this notion that there's nothing we can do about unemployment and that, in fact, we can't secure an economy that provides jobs for all and that we can deal with evils of inflation or whatever other problems we might think are looming on the horizon without keeping people without their basic means and necessity and without basic access to employment opportunities. So the first thing is to say, no, the economy might generate unemployment, but that's really not unavoidable. We have very concrete ways of tackling it. Number two, no, we should not be using unemployment as a policy guide. There is no moral or economic argument that we should be saying that 5 million people are optimally out of work. That's a notion that I think we need to, you know, really leave behind. There are some rumbling, some changes in among central bankers trying to give up, you know, maybe trying to de-emphasize the NAIRU, but the idea that there is a natural unemployment rate is still there. Okay, and so and number three, we want to provide an alternative. We want to be able to envision a world in which if somebody wants work, they can walk into the American Job Center and they can get at a minimum a dignified job that pays dignified living wages. So that was the goal of the book, to question this paradigm, to question the status quo, and, you know, hopefully shake us into thinking of creative ways to secure this very basic right to work. And the job guarantee really is the direct, most straightforward assurance.
I wanted to add something that I think frames the whole discussion. Because there is a counter narrative that wants to minimize how central the opportunity to have a job is to the economic independence that serves as a basis for being able to exercise all of our other freedoms. And that's this view that everyone can be an entrepreneur, which has as its corollary the idea that small business is in a way an essential core of a market economy. But the fact is, and I think this is a fact we all perceive around us, and it's something that follows from the logic of market relations, is that competition requires firms to grow and consolidate in order to remain competitive. And that means in every market society, we end up having a huge mass of people who are employees and a much smaller number of employers. And in addition to that, anyone who is among the few who have access to sufficient wealth or credit to try to open a business or to have rentable property, they know that if they fail and are driven out of work, driven out of business, they have what everyone else possesses in a society that's eliminated slavery. Namely, they are owners of their own labor power. And that ends up being the bedrock of any opportunity to have a livelihood. And that's why we have to recognize that the opportunity to work, to be employed, is the ground zero of economic independence.
And along those lines, could you maybe describe sort of the problematic of unemployment in general, like just expanding? Professor Cherneva, you describe unemployment as a cancer. It's extensive collateral damage. So could you describe explicitly how unemployment is an affliction with huge negative costs?
Yeah, I mean, just to pick up on Richard's point, unemployment is something we see in market economies. You know, you don't really have you know, feudal or communally organized societies that have mass unemployment. And we have a very particular way of organizing life and production in a market system. And that is, a lot of it is through wage work and having access to necessity, basic necessities, opportunities through finding wage employment. Now, but in this system, production is organized, on these entrepreneurial bases that Richard is describing, and the offer of employment is strictly connected to the profitability of that employment, for the most part, right? That's the private, you know, the private market system generates the vast majority of employment opportunities, but they are based on this principle of, is it profitable to do so? Now, when you think about social organization and how we provision for ourselves in general, we do all sorts of things that have to be done that are not that may not generate profit or commercial return, right? We recognize that we have to create a lot of employment and a lot of work that serves the public purpose and the public good. You know, that's why we have public sector workers. That's why we have public schools. That's why we have public hospitals. I mean, you name it. There's just so much work that has to be done and goes neglected and not really done. So the job guarantee actually flips a little bit the logic of the offer of employment. It says, okay, if the market mechanism creates so many employment opportunities based on the profit principle, well, we can certainly create other employment opportunities just because it is a right to do so, and because there is plenty of need, and there are folks who need work. In other words, there is also a public purpose to address the scourge of unemployment. And what is that scourge of unemployment? You know, I'm a macroeconomist, so I look at the unemployment problem from like a bird's eye view. And if you look at how the economy behaves on medium or long term, you notice that unemployment shoots up in recessions, in pandemics, in financial crises. It accelerates. Lots of people lose their livelihoods in the midst of these downturns. And then the economy is very sluggish in creating enough employment opportunities, and it never creates enough for all. Okay, so you could imagine that this labor market that we all rely on so desperately for our livelihood is this giant yo-yo, right? Giant yo-yo. Another way in which I describe this is a game of musical chairs. But now imagine that cruel game of musical chairs is on the deck of a boat in a very stormy sea. And so what ends up happening is some folks never are able to get a chair. They're never able to get a job. Other folks are able to get employment opportunities, but lose them quickly. This is what we call the last in first out phenomena. There are folks that just have great obstacles to employment. They will be the first ones to be laid off, the last ones to be hired, build lower tenure on the job experience, income or assets to survive the storm. And so there are a lot of ways in which the labor market just reproduces economic injustices because we tolerate mass unemployment. So unemployment as this pervasive feature is a structural problem. And it inflicts enormous social and economic costs. So when you said the plague of unemployment, that is not just in terms of economic terms, you know, we lose output and we lose human capabilities, but it actually causes a lot of health effects, a lot of social costs, a lot of, you can think of virtually any social problem would be connected in one way or another to unemployment, from suicide rates to health, mental health problems, to children outcomes in schools. I mean, there are many. And if we were to account for all of them, I think we will quickly realize that unemployment is not natural. It actually causes huge economic and social costs. And the fastest way to inoculate against this disease is to guarantee decent living wage opportunities to people who need them.
I wanted to add another dimension to this. I mean, you've written powerfully about the way in which unemployment is like a metastasizing cancer, where it generates more unemployment insofar as the unemployed lose their purchasing power, which is not good for businesses and so forth. But I think there's another side to it that I think has become something of which we're more and more aware with the Me Too movement. And that's the effect of the fear of firing that exists with the toleration of mass unemployment. First of all, it is bad for those who have a job and are trying to fight for better work conditions and better pay, because you have this reserve army of the unemployed threatening to replace them or work for less. But then you also have a situation where people are very, very scared, with good reason, to blow the whistle on harassment on the job, sexual harassment, racial discrimination, employer misconduct of any sort, because you risk losing your employment, which means you have no income. And in the United States, it's often tied to benefits that are crucial, such as healthcare. So not only do you lose income, you lose the healthcare you and your family need. And for this reason, it's easy for those who have power at the workplace to get away with all sorts of mistreatment because we tolerate unemployment.
I completely agree with this. I mean, unemployment is such a powerful, powerful force of racial, gender discrimination, of and so many kind of inequities in the labor market. And so we try to pass a lot of policies that are well-intended, that attempt to deal with multiple aspects of labor market, multiple problems in the labor market, anti-discrimination laws, minimum wage laws, better protections for workers. But, you know, without the job guarantee, they're never going to be entirely sufficient and adequate because of that threat of unemployment that Richard is highlighting. What ends up happening is that unemployment doesn't just affect the unemployed, but also folks who work, because they lose their voice in the working place. You know, we can't truly democratize the working place if that threat of unemployment looms over their heads. And so, you know, this well-known insider-outsider dynamic dominates. And so as a worker, you might be quite ready to accept all sorts of terrible working conditions, harassment, loss of benefits, because you don't want to lose the job. And so when you, I mean, we can put some specific examples of what a labor market does that has perennial unemployment. For example, caregivers who have been out of work for a very long time are the last ones to get employment opportunities. It's better to be an unemployed parent than a long-term caregiver in terms of finding work. We know that people with disabilities, they were the last ones to see improvement in their employment scenario after the great financial crisis. They're again, the last ones to get a foot in the door. And US labor law is terrible. It allows employers to pay below minimum wages for folks with disability. We know that, racism and is reproduced through economic insecurity. There are multiple layers to this problem, but we also know from good work from sociology that folks, Black folks without a criminal record, are called back for interviews less often than white people with a criminal record. Now, there is the perennial problem is unemployment. And so when we talk about anti-poverty programs, et cetera, without a job guarantee, we are kind of redistributing these opportunities in different ways. And what we need to do is make a firm commitment that anyone, whatever walk of life, whatever their personal circumstance, will be secured a living wage employment. And then we can do all these other, we can implement all these other remedies to address the various other forms in which folks may be mistreated in the labor market. They may experience wage theft, may they experience discrimination, harassment. All of those good policies will stand more firmly on a framework that actually has eradicated the threat of unemployment.
One other crucial benefit of the eradication of unemployment is you continually encounter these arguments whenever one raises any kind of reform that would require businesses to have increased production costs, whether it's a matter of having paid leave or of raising salaries or of having 1 month paid vacation or of protecting the environment or reducing work hours, having safer work conditions, and so forth. One always will face the argument saying, well, if we make those expenses, we're gonna have to lay off some people. Well, if we have a job guarantee, that argument is moot. And that also means that no localities have to go begging to employers, prospective employers, saying we're gonna reduce taxes and so forth to try to lure you here. Yeah. All of that becomes unnecessary.
Right. I mean, states are engaged in an arms race, if you will, of providing subsidies and tax cuts to firms that, you know, hopefully they will relocate to for in the name of job creation. I mean, we also know that that doesn't these subsidies don't really create net new jobs. They actually shift jobs from one state to another. So if we have a job guarantee, then they're not so dependent, not just on giving large subsidies and tax cuts to large corporations to relocate, but they also not dependent on other forms of employment that might be environmentally damaging, dehumanizing. You might not be dependent on the local prison to create all the jobs for your community. You might not tolerate the oil rig that is off your shores because they're holding a couple hundred jobs as hostage over that community. We have an alternative mechanism for job creation that that provides that certainty that a living wage job will be around the corner.
So we've established, or y'all have established, a little bit of sort of the ripple effects that something like a job guarantee could have, especially when it comes to deciding what the public sector will actually do. So my next question would be, what actually sets more the job guarantee apart as opposed to, say, focusing on Medicare as a public option? What is its difference when it comes to public commodities? And also maybe stage this debate in comparison to other proposals that might have hopefully similar effects, but might not do it as well when it comes to questions about jobs, replacing jobs that might be phasing out. That would be the universal basic income as a potential solution as well. So Professor Cherneva.
Okay, so how can we see the job guarantee as a public option as compared to other policies? Mm-hmm. Well, let's take education, for example. I mean, we have made as a society a firm commitment that no child will be denied access to a school. You know, it will be guaranteed public education. Now, people have the capacity to go to private schools as well, right? But those who don't are assured public education. We have the right to a public defender. You know, again, all of these policies need a lot of improvement, but we do think in terms of having the public sector as providing a backstop. I think of public libraries as in these terms as well. That's the right to publicly accessible education. Every community has a public library. You can have access to private libraries, right? But as a society, we have decided that this is a crucial, you know, access for citizenry. Now, employment is this absolutely life-sustaining, crucial, inherent part of how we, you know, how we self-determine, you know, the choices we make, our individual family, social freedoms are contingent on having access to paid employment. But as a society, we kind of have abdicated our responsibility to guarantee it to all. And we say, let's just the market sort it out. And as we've established, the market sector does not provide employment opportunity for all. So the public option is this, much like Social Security. If you don't have private retirement, we guarantee public Social Security, right? If you don't have private education, we guarantee public education. If you don't have private employment, we guarantee public employment. So in that sense, it is a legally enforced right to decent employment. Now, it's a little different from if you meant Medicare for all, because Medicare for all is basically supposed to be one universal healthcare system for all. The job guarantee is a little different. It's not the employer of first resort, it's the employer of last resort. And it works within a market system for the following reason. As I discussed earlier, in a market economy, employment goes up and goes down. We need to have a stabilizing force. We can't have people be the collateral damage of profits declining or sales declining, and you know they're laid off en masse whenever that happens. So we know that the economies have a heartbeat. We know that the business cycle is a thing for a market economy, and we know that people lose their jobs. And so the job guarantee is the stabilizer. It's a very firm automatic stabilizer that provides employment precisely at the time when people need them most, need employment opportunities the most. But also it provides employment in good times when quietly and folks have lost their jobs, but they become invisible to policymaking, but they're still there. And so the job guarantees that safety net as well. There's a lot that we can say to compare the job guarantee with universal basic income, but I think one thing that is quite obvious is that universal basic income is not an automatic stabilizer in this sense. Because at least the proposals for universal income provided to every citizen, they will be there rain or shine, all right? They're much larger in terms of the kind of expenditure that will be required. But more importantly, they don't solve the problem of unemployment. People still need jobs. And we know this very well, not just from basic income experiments, that when folks are provided with basic income, they still need work and the work is not there. So there isn't a structural reform present to guarantee that employment opportunity will be there. And of course, I think very importantly, maybe Amartya Sen's concept of substantive freedom, and Richard has written a lot about this, that freedom is not acquired just by providing income, right? It is also by providing opportunities. And many of those opportunities come from being in the workplace, being recognized, contributing to a collective effort, being able to have work that is valued for its social benefits, not just for its commercial returns.
That point is very important also in respect to a lot of proposals that have been made, some by people who also favor a federal job guarantee, the idea that individuals should be given a certain amount of wealth as a way of providing economic security to them. That underlies all sorts of land reform proposals that have been around, right, from the days of the Russian Empire and decolonization to the idea of 40 acres and a mule in Reconstruction, to the ideas of baby bonds, microloans, and so forth. But I think it's a fundamental mistake to think that wealth is giving people a certain stakehold is equivalent to giving them the opportunity to exercise their social freedom in an enduring way. And
maybe this
also is why the job guarantee is so crucial.
Yeah, and maybe it's important to connect the job guarantee to the broader agenda that Richard is talking about. We're talking about economic insecurity, and there are many dimensions to economic insecurity and many ways in which we provide economic security to all. And a job is a crucial missing component that we just have not been talking about. We are engaged somewhat in a conversation of guaranteeing healthcare, which is long overdue in this country. We are doing a poor job of providing good public education to all. We're doing a poor job of providing decent housing to all. But these are multiple dimensions of economic insecurity that require our policy attention. And so I tend to think of the job guarantee as a piece, kind of a crucial piece in this broader framework of securing economic rights. And that conversation is being revived right now. I think that the financial crisis, COVID, they're exposing all of these pathologies in the labor market. And we are returning to some useful and good old ideas of giving workers more union power, giving them more representation in the workplace. Richard has talked about this, democratizing the workplace, providing protections. But again, if we're having these conversations without also guaranteeing the legally enforceable right to employment, we will not be able to secure those essentials for all. And the labor market is still going to reproduce its racial, gender, and other injustices.
Along these lines of conversation, we have a nice input from the audience. Catalin Toth, I'm sorry if I messed that up. They ask in plain terms, why is it that the job guarantee is better as opposed to UBI when we are living in a time when automation is eliminating the demand for a workforce more and more? Is it not a danger to the people just to merely get fake jobs as a waste of their time?
I get that question a lot. And the way to think of it is that jobs and automation do not need to be pitted against each other. You know, if we have job guarantee, we can embrace automation. And we should embrace it even faster. We should automate away dangerous jobs, you know, hazardous jobs. We should reduce the working hour. We should increase productivity, the working day, the working week, right? We can actually make technology be our ally. But because we don't guarantee the right to employment, technology is the threat. And so you can now start envisioning what can society do that is not being done that requires folks and technology. I think we have some obvious answers. We have an enormous climate crisis ahead of us. It will take all manner of technology, skill, know-how, people in every corner, in every community around the world to address this important concern. So in other words, there's plenty of work to do. And we can do it in tandem with technology, but we don't want to, you know, pit these. We are pitting them against each other because folks don't have an alternative. The other thing is that, you know, I appreciate the concern with so-called bullshit jobs that David Graeber had written about. And note that a lot of these jobs are often in the private sector when firms are trying to manage workers, when there's an enormous administrative structure to make sure that they are disciplined to perform according to the precise criteria that firms require them. Now envision a different kind of organization that's based on participatory democracy, a community organized jobs program that attends to very concrete social community needs. It's hard to say that these are bullshit jobs, right? These are sorely needed, neglected, overlooked areas of a public concern that we can use the job guarantee to address.
And we need to remember how important are all those jobs that cannot be automated, all those jobs that require a robot-proof human touch, such as what I do as a philosophy professor of philosophy, such as what you do as an economic theorist and teacher, and what artists do, and musicians and so forth, and all the people providing any kind of human care. I mean, all of these are areas where we do want people to be working and where they can't be replaced or mechanized out of existence. And when we're talking about unemployment, we're talking about people who, in a sense, are willing and able to do all sorts of activities of this kind, which obviously contribute to the humanity of our existence and to the irreplaceable human element.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point. A lot of people think of manufacturing jobs and they think of them with nostalgia, right? Because, you know, they gave good incomes to families. They created communities, you know, community wealth opportunities. But manufacturing jobs, as much as we still talk about them, they are only 8% of total employment in the United States. If you bring all the manufacturing jobs back to the United States, we still won't create 100% employment in manufacturing. Now, so the question is, why aren't service sector jobs creating that decent standard of living? We have, you know, 42% of people who are working are earning less than $15 an hour. And this is a service economy. This is a care economy, just like Richard said, right? What we do is, you know, we take care of each other. I mean, we don't just educate each other and entertain each other. We feed ourselves, you know, we transport. There is so much that we do in the service sector. And that is that human touch. But somehow we have allowed that work to be done at poverty-paying wages. We are realizing acutely how those essential workers that we're lauding as heroes are working in despicable conditions. They are not able to support themselves and their families, and that is unacceptable. So yes, we should raise the minimum wage. We should provide adequate protections. But if you don't have a job, your minimum wage will still be zero. And we need to be able to guarantee that structural reform that lifts the floor that is an uncompromising minimum wage floor. And that would help immediately provide that labor standard for the service sector jobs that dominate this economy. It won't be enough, but it is the minimum that we are required to do.
So when it comes to making large public sector decisions, oftentimes the question comes, how do we pay for something like a federal jobs guarantee? You already hinted earlier about the cost of a UBI. Could you go over maybe your conception of the payment process for something like this, the means to an end? And could you maybe go into detail on how you foresee the federal job guarantee being implemented realistically? And also maybe in relation to the you talked about the difference between a public and a private sector job. Can you maybe go into more about this tension between a big government takeover and the size and the health of diminishing the size and the health of the private sector?
Okay.
Potentially.
Yeah, I'll start with the last question. Most people don't realize we have very big government today to deal with mass unemployment. I mean, first of all, you know, we have millions and millions of people out of work. They are the responsibility of the public sector. Even as the public sector is abdicating this responsibility, it is still going to be responsible for not just paying unemployment insurance, but also for the malnourished children that are going into school that you need to provide meals for the people who are going to be weaker and sicker and showing up at the hospitals. Those are going to be costs that are incurred for the incarceration of folks who don't have employment. Those are costs that are there. They're existing costs. And then we're going to go chase some big corporations with very large subsidies and tax cuts, praying and hoping that they will create some employment in the communities that have mass unemployment. We have very big government already to deal with the problem of unemployment. I'll give you an example. The state of New Jersey a few years ago had contemplated offering anywhere between $1 and $5 billion subsidy to Amazon to establish their warehousing in the state. The budget was enough to hire every single unemployed person at a living wage. So this is what I'm talking about when I talk about a direct solution. We are already spending the money in the name of job creation, and because we have a responsibility to address unemployment and the fallout, we do it terribly, very poorly, but the expense is there. Now imagine if we just employed the unemployed. How many people will it help? Will it help to be able to pay their bills, to prevent evictions, to reduce the health costs? So the way I see the job guarantees, I see it as a cost reducing program, not just the existing financial costs, but the real costs that we're incurring. So we have a choice. I mean, we either pay for the neglect and the devastation that unemployment brings, or we pay for employment and the good that will come out of those public service employment opportunities that we will be creating in areas, as I said, like in green investments and other areas in public service. So that will be number one. How is it paid for? But most people actually think about the money. Right? Where's the money coming from? Well, it comes from the federal government. The federal government is responsible and capable, the only institution that is capable of providing universal safety net at all times, rain or shine. And the reason is because it has the power of the public purse. What does that mean? The power of the public purse means that it is self-financing. The government funds itself. Whenever it faces a crisis, it has the financial means and resources to pay for its policies. I mean, we have teachable moment after teachable moment on this count. What did we do in March? We passed 10% of GDP budget, extraordinary by all measures, right? $2.2 trillion overnight. And every bill was paid, no check bounced. Why? Because we have financing institutions that make sure that those government checks get paid. Treasury and the Fed stand behind to pay the bills. Now, we got to recognize this and we have to embrace it. so that we don't get trapped into this false narrative that the government is running out of money or that it somehow is dependent on its rich taxpayers to fund its programs. We have the financial means. Now, for states, this is a problem. States definitely run out of money. States go bankrupt. They have balanced budget amendments. They don't have a treasury and a central bank to pay the bills. And they then suffer disproportionately the costs of unemployment. They are responsible for a lot of the social programs that need to be implemented to deal with those social costs. So a federal program will tremendously help states and will improve their budgets. Who don't have the kind of financial capacity the federal government does. I think there was another part to the question, but I think I forgot it.
I'd like to chime in regarding two points. And that is, besides all of the immense savings of, in a sense, removing many of the social pathologies and injustices that, you know, we spend well over $1 trillion attempting to cope with, we have to recognize that when we put people to work on a job guarantee, they are producing goods and services that have a value. And there's no reason to think that the level of productivity in the federal job program will be anything different from that anywhere else in the economy, which means by and large, what will be produced will be of a value equal or greater than the cost of its production. And that means we are producing, in the case of the investments in both human services, infrastructure, arts and music and so forth, public riches that are of great significance. And in addition, with regard to the issue of the government being able to fund all of these things, right? We, you know, we have our fiat currency, you know, we can enlarge the money supply. But one of the things that will protect us against inflation is the fact that we will be increasing the supply of goods and services that are there in the economy, so that we don't have this imbalance between the amount of money and the value of commodities that are being circulated.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very, I think, an important point, and I appreciate you bringing it up. So, I mean, two comparisons. Unemployment's productivity is negative, okay? So that's the first basis of comparison. So when you employ a person, it's gonna be better than zero, better than negative and the loss of all of that, human potential and all of these enormous social and economic costs. So it's an improvement immediately over the current scenario. But as Richard said, how do we evaluate the whether these policies are going to be to enhance economic stability? We're not gonna evaluate them in terms of their financial, like the financial costs, because we know the financial costs are already there, and we know that the government can pay the bills without threatening, you know, insolvency. But inflation is going to be one consideration. And the job guarantee has this feature that it actually moves anti-cyclically, which means that when the economy is growing, when wages are growing, when employment is booming, people are actually moving out of the job guarantee into private sector employment. So the program shrinks when the private sector grows. And that is that tampering force, that anti-inflationary force. And when the economy is collapsing and experiencing what we call deflationary forces, you know, people are laid off, they're losing their incomes, they're selling off their houses. The job guarantee flips off the floor. It provides the necessary stimulus to kickstart the economy again, except we don't do it by tolerating mass jobless recoveries. The very expenditure on job creation is the very stimulus that greases the economic wheels. So it is anti-inflationary in that sense. And it also secures firmly the floor. So in other words, it lifts up the floor, where in the current system, what we do is we try to create a lot of jobs through these various firm subsidies, et cetera, but firms tend to hire the employed, the high-skilled workers, those with longer tenure, which means that there is a bidding up of wages at the top of the income distribution. So relatively speaking, the job guarantee actually improves the lives and the conditions precisely of those folks who need this income support the most.
So, Richard, you identify this federal jobs guarantee as a part of this social bill of rights that I mentioned earlier. Could you give us a brief introduction in how this is such a keystone to a broader progressive agenda for something like a Green New Deal or Medicare for All or the ilk?
Well, I think proposal for the Green New Deal explicitly incorporates a federal job guarantee for a very important reason. In making a transition from a fossil fuel-based economy to one that is going to rely upon green energy, that is going to threaten unemployment for people who earn a living in the fossil fuel industry. And if we are going to make the transition in a way that both is going to be politically palatable and just, the federal job guarantee comes in guaranteeing that those people who are coal miners or working in oil exploration, et cetera, that they will have a job awaiting them and jobs that will be serving the community. You know, we can discuss later exactly how it will be implemented and how those jobs will be determined. But it's a key element in making that transition, as well as putting people to work in things that for various reasons of market prerogatives are not being attended to. After all, the fossil fuel industry has all sorts of fixed assets, which they don't want to abandon. And they're reluctant to make the transition themselves, even though they're the richest industry in human history. But federal job guarantee can begin making public investments in the kind of things that need to be done. With regard to something like Medicare for All, here too, we are not necessarily outlawing, but making completely unnecessary a for-profit health insurance industry, which has employees. We know health providers have bloated secretarial staffs to handle this great multitude of competing for-profit health insurance plans. Those jobs are going to be in jeopardy if we make the transition to Medicare for All. Federal job guarantee solves the problem. These people are going to be able to have guaranteed employment and meaningful employment. And I think another important aspect, it makes possible a fair, comprehensive immigration reform, because there are people who do feel threatened by legalizing the undocumented, increasing immigration and so forth. Because after all, there are people who did do the jobs that employers have now handed over to illegal immigrants who they can pay less and manipulate. Federal job guarantee removes that kind of fear, which is stoking this anti-democratic nationalism, which Trump is making use of, and leaders around the world are employing. So I think it has a key role in all of these various spheres in allowing us to make important reforms that fulfill our rights and that depend upon there being the job guarantee in place to be successful.
And maybe to point out one of the differences that we have, particularly on the campaign here, is that there is, we talked a bit earlier about, or you did, Professor Cherneva, about the $15 an hour minimum wage and that being very important to the federal job guarantee. But why is it that you locate the $15 an hour and why do you set that only at $15 an hour, to be more provocative? You allow it to be subject to payroll taxes and federal income taxes and accept benefits that are tied to employment. So,
yes. No, as I write in my book, you know, 15 is probably not enough already. You know, we keep having these conversations. I've been writing about the job guarantee for 20 years and, you know, upping up the wage, but, you know, by the time, you know, people start paying attention, it probably should be at 20. And I know Richard is proposing 22. Now, the reason why in this book is at 15 is to help with legislative efforts to move up to 15 immediately. I think that we have established legislative schedules. And so phasing in the wage will be important from a macroeconomic perspective. We do know that firms are able to raise wages relatively quickly, even overnight. We know that they kick and scream whenever there are living wage ordinances at the city level, at state level, they still meet them. And so I think that, but when we are talking about 42% of the population earning less than $15 an hour. We want to find the best mechanism of increasing everybody's living wage without necessarily flooding the program with the vast majority of folks, right? You know, making it balloon to 80%, let's say. I think the best way to do this is having a floor, a living wage floor at the for the job guarantee in tandem with a minimum wage legislation, because then that will pressure firms a lot faster to meet the standard. And I think that the wage has to increase lockstep with productivity. So perhaps we can envision a schedule where the wage would reach, I don't know, 22 on a little more accelerated basis. But I thought that the $15 an hour will be a non-disruptive wage on the near term that will help with the existing legislative efforts, and it will meet that, improve the lives of, you know, the vast majority of workers. Certainly open to policy design and, you know, putting it in place in a way that it doesn't increase costs too fast, right? So what we want to do is we want to make sure that we don't have a huge jump in prices, which firms may have to engage in to recover the wage costs. Okay. And why is it connected to benefits? I mean, I'm not advocating that the job care, that the jobs, that Medicare will be, or healthcare should be connected to jobs. But if somebody is providing a job, they should at a minimum provide healthcare in the absence of universal coverage. So, I mean, this is, you know, just another step in improving the lives of working people in the absence of federal action on the issue of healthcare. I mean, I think that the far superior solution is to provide universal healthcare disconnected from status of employment. That's the socially just thing to do.
So, I mean, I'm not going to quibble too much on this because I think, you know, it is a question of putting it forward and dealing with, let's say, current political attitudes. But I think you are agreed that we do ultimately want to separate healthcare from employment. Even if we had guaranteed employment, I think we also would want to separate decent pensions from employment and all the other opportunities that are required. I think it'd be interesting for you to discuss how you see the job program actually implemented and the way in which federal and local authorities would be operating and what kind of things you would see being instituted.
Yeah. So there are a couple of problems in terms of implementation. I mean, my preference is for the job guarantee to be implemented when the economy is doing very well and unemployment is very low. But it is in the midst and the depths of mass unemployment that people are starting to pay attention, and they're wondering, well, how are we going to put to work 30 million people? Now, let me just say, this is not an insurmountable problem because large-scale jobs programs are always implemented in the depths of a crisis, whether it's the Great Depression, whether it is the crisis of Argentina, whether it is, you know, mass unemployment in India. They are always created in the depths of a crisis. We know that they can be up and running on short order. Now, we're thinking of this program, however, as a structural permanent policy. So I would, in my ideal world, I would not want the job guarantee to do the heavy lift, heavy lifting and do the burden of doing, for example, the Green New Deal. It is a critical piece, but the Green New Deal, as it is conceived correctly, is an industrial policy that employs at every skill level, in many different areas in industries. So my preference would be for the public sector to be adequately staffed to make sure that there are highly skilled, highly qualified people at every step, at every level, where the public service has been neglected for a very long time, whether it is CDC staff, whether it is FDA inspectors, whether it is public school teachers, whether it is public hospitals. I would prefer that they were a blank check for hiring in those public areas of permanent social need, but there will still be need for a job guarantee because, as we said, The market moves up and down and people are going to be losing their jobs as a consequence. What could we do? If we put in place a job guarantee as a locally administered framework that provides employment opportunities as people come in into the program, where could they go? I think a program of shadowing teachers, shadowing nurses, doing kind of on-the-job training programs where they can then acquire the skills to transition to that area once employment conditions recover, that is a good way of going about it. At the same time, we know that communities have many organizations that attend to specific needs, environmental needs, as I said, the invisible work, in my own community, we have, volunteers that clean up the streets, they go neighborhood from neighborhood to neighborhood to, clean up the streets. I mean, that is a public function that can be expanded or as needed when people come in. We know that trees are the lungs of the cities. That is one tiny thing that we need to do as part of the Green New Deal, plant trees. It's called unproductive work. It is essential. It's our livelihood depends on it. We have communities that are perennially bombarded with the climate problems, from flooding in the Midwest to fires in California. We need an army of people to do the job. And some of those people will need to do the job permanently. But they will be suitable places for employment, those who show up, who have lost work. And the job guarantee attempts to provide employment opportunities that are suitable to people and their capacities. So, you can envision people digitizing maps, historical maps, doing oral history projects. I mean, you name it. I think that if we just kind of open up our vision of what we value as a society, we will find employment opportunities for artists, for musicians, for folks with all sorts of capabilities that they can contribute to the community. But the reality is we need to recognize that the market, the labor market is cruel, and it's the low-skilled folks that tend to experience the most economic insecurity, and we have to be able to provide very firm employment safety net for them.
So as a general question, I'm going to try and weave some of the comments that have been firing off. What's the deal for those who have problems in the private sector retaining a job? Those who, as one puts it, chronically unemployed people who have difficulty seeking work in strong labor markets. I think chronic absenteeism, but also those who have maybe disabilities or something like this. What's their place when it comes to federal job guarantees? Richard?
First of all, I think one has to recognize that much of the difficulty people have in retaining a job has to do with what's going on in the rest of their life. Are they getting adequate healthcare, both physical and mental? What is their family situation? Are their households being provided with the kind of services they need to keep themselves together and get rid of all sorts of relations of domestic abuse and the like? I mean, there are a lot of factors that obviously make it very difficult for someone to carry out one's job and perform it up to the standards of an employer. And that obviously requires dealing with other aspects of our social rights, healthcare, housing, having decent housing. I mean, obviously it's very difficult to work if you're homeless and keep a job if you're homeless, or you have either unsafe housing and the like, and likewise, it's always a pressure balancing work and family. If you find you have to take off from work to care for family members, be it younger family members, older family members, right, it becomes impossible to maintain your job. So we have to deal with those aspects. We have to ensure that people have adequate child and elder care so they can be at work and maintain their career and know that family matters are being taken care of. And I think one has to keep in mind that, many people will say, well, what happens if you have someone who is offered a job in a federal job guarantee program, but they don't do the work? Are they going to be paid? Well, I think there's no reason to think that the situation should be very different in this public sector employment from anywhere else. If they don't do the work, they're not going to be paid. That doesn't mean they won't have a chance to get further employment again. But in order to be, let's say, to retain their employment, to be paid, they have to do the work in some fashion or other. And again, there can be all sorts of pathologies at work or all sorts of other dimensions of their life where they're not getting the support they need that have to be attended to resolve these issues. And that also has to deal with the issue of the disabled. I mean, a federal job guarantee can bend over backwards to provide employment to people who have disabilities that the private sector is not willing to deal with because of the added expense, right? We can try to accommodate them as best we can, as we should.
And Professor Cherneva, you talk about the federal job guarantee being a National Care Act, and some of these responses, I think maybe that Professor Winfield has laid out might be hovering around this idea. Could you unpack maybe what it means to be a National Care Act in
light of that? Yes, maybe just to emphasize Richard's last point, I want to say we really need to think about the chronically unemployed as being chronically unemployed, not because of their personal choices. This is a narrative that we have to put an end to. We need to understand the macroeconomy and how structurally it does not create employment for all, even in the best of times. It is true that some folks have their own individual obstacles to holding on to a job. That is true. However, as a macroeconomic phenomena, those who are chronically unemployed are there because for one reason or another, the private sector has deemed them unproductive according to private sector standards, but it doesn't mean that those folks have nothing to contribute or useful to produce. But because the way the private labor market works, it tosses them out first and hires them last. And once you end up in that pool of people, and you end up being unemployed for longer and longer and longer periods of time, your chances of reemployment plummet. And so you could try to pull yourself by your bootstraps and do all sorts of things. But so long as the market doesn't create enough employment opportunities for all, somebody's going to strike out, even if they've made all the right choices. Now, for some folks who are having specific obstacles to holding on a job, just like Richard said, there are other interventions that are critical to make sure people are successful. That's what a CARE Act is. A CARE Act is that we simply conceive of the economy as a care economy, and that we are going to support care kind of activities. You might be a veteran who has trouble holding on to a job. We will do programs for veterans, and they will be managed by veterans, right? So we're going to try to empower people to also do some of the interventions and programs from which they can benefit. You may be a young person having trouble in school and finishing high school. The job guarantee will provide GED completion and apprenticeship opportunities. You might be somebody in a mining community, right? That's been decimated from loss of industry. Now, that's not a personal choice or a shortcoming that folks are chronically unemployed there, but the job guarantee is going to re-envision what those mining communities can do. And it's very interesting that there has been strong support from mining communities for these kinds of direct employment programs. There are Appalachian communities that have sort of filled the mines and tried to restore, do some ecological restoration. There are others who are understanding that the Green New Deal actually is a solution to the decline in mining. So there is really a lot of work to do. We got to take care of the environment. We got to take care of folks. We got to take care of these communities. And that's what that means. The job guarantee puts people to work in socially useful employment projects that address things that I think we all see around and recognize, and we wish that they were done, but there's simply no direct action on behalf of the public sector to do so.
Well, It seems to be that our time is about up. I'm sorry we weren't able to get to everybody's questions. I want to allow y'all both have closing statements or, you know, some final points, remarks, just especially in relation.
I would like to jump in first because I actually want to address two questions. To Pavlina, and one has to do with the issue of unionization of people on the federal job guarantee program, because as you formulated, we don't want to have tiered levels of wages, and we might have some kind of adjustments, inflation adjustments, maybe productivity adjustments built in, but the sense is we're in a program that is providing the floor of economic independence. And then the question is, well, how will unions come into play? And the second question I had is, how can we think of a job guarantee as an international program? I mean, I think we all realize that the Green New Deal has to be implemented internationally. You know, we account for only 15% of greenhouse gas emissions at this point. And a Green New Deal does incorporate the idea of guaranteed jobs to ensure that in making the transition, people are going to have a livelihood guaranteed to them. So how do you think we deal with unionization in such programs? And what do you think are the ways in which it could be implemented as an international program?
Yeah, I mean, in my book, I argue that the job guarantee should have its own union, and you know, job guarantee workers can then advocate for their own conditions of employment. I think that, you know, the work of unions has been made much more difficult because it is done in conditions of perennial unemployment. Now imagine what that work would be if you are a union, service sector union, or any other union where the threat of unemployment is considerably diminished, right? I think it's very important that the job guarantee is not a substitute for traditional public sector employment, as I highlighted earlier. And so when you're contracting out, you know, for major projects that require union work, that's what you do. You pay the prevailing wages, you pay the, you know, the union, you meet the terms of the unions. The job guarantee is that residual employment program, if you will. Okay. Now, I think that we should align in terms of what we're trying to do, which is really remove the threat of unemployment and improve the lives of working people. And improving the lives of working people requires establishing a firm floor below which no one can fall. So I think I see us as natural allies. I think maybe not everyone sees this, but I see us as very much, very much natural allies, which is why I think we've seen strong interest from service unions. But this is, as you say, a problem that is a global problem. This is not just a US-based problem. Mass unemployment is a scourge in every corner of the world. And it has caused, a lot of devastation. And it's very often, created these kind of unintended consequences. For example, a lot of folks are afraid of outsourcing of employment, right? So trade policies are very much done in the context of mass unemployment. And these false promises of bringing jobs back, they are false promises. Maybe some jobs are going to be brought back. We haven't seen that happen. But at the global level, it's going to be a zero-sum game if we don't have an employment program globally. So I advocate for a global Marshall Plan of full employment that is spearheaded by international institutions that will facilitate the implementation of a job guarantee around the world. We do have precedents where a legally enforceable right to employment exists. We do have it in the United Declaration of Human Rights. We do have it in many constitutions around the world that are inspired by the UN Declaration. We have a precedent where the world was engaged in such a global conversation right after World War II, when we understood that the benefits of trade can come in conditions of tight full employment. If people feel that they're losing their jobs because of free trade, it's not gonna work. We understood this once, and we need to kind of recognize it again and understand that you know, that kind of free flow, if you will, of goods is contingent on job security. It's contingent on full employment in every corner of the world. So I don't think that this is an entirely insurmountable task in the sense that we have once engaged in this kind of conversation. Of course, today we face multi-level crises. And I think we need to tackle them boldly. There's an inescapable realization that the public sector has to do something to address all of these multiple crises. And having the job guarantee at the center of public health crisis, environmental crisis, unemployment crises is really a kind of robust way of moving forward.
Well, since we have a little bit more time, just a quick answer, I guess we could try and get. This is maybe more of a philosophical question. One of what is it about the federal job guarantee that might, some might argue that a job is the more noble option, that you gain some sort of value from your labor and seeing the fruits of that. Is this a compelling argument for the federal job guarantee, or is it more strong? Is it stronger to stick in economic terms? Professor Cherneva, if you would.
Okay. So, I mean, the job guarantee is a very particular structural policy that is missing in the current economic context. It's essential because without it, we will be guaranteed unemployment. And so that's the choice we have to make. Do you want guaranteed employment or guaranteed unemployment? So from a macroeconomic perspective, to me, there's no question which one is superior. I think the philosophical question is whether one's worth is determined by their job. I think that's where that question is leading. And the answer is, of course, not. But the reality is, the unavoidable reality is that we as human beings, we work. We organize, we do things to provide for ourselves, and we find various ways in which we organize that work and provision for ourselves. And the market mechanism happens to be one mechanism in which we provide for ourselves, and clearly it's inadequate. It doesn't provide for all. And it's creating inhumane, externalities, right? And so the job guarantee in that sense recognizes that, yes, of course, we value human input, not just because it's profitable, but because there is a social value to it. Because we, as a society, recognize that it takes work to solve our problems. And the job guarantee is that I think philosophically recognize that we need to value this kind of work.
Professor Winfield.
You can look at the job guarantee for enforcing the right to work as something that is basic to ensuring that individuals are able to exercise a certain kind of self-determination. Because unlike other forms of economic organization, where you have a certain function to fulfill by birth because of what rank you're born into, because of things that are given completely independently of your choice. Here we're exercising an activity where you are not on simply the receiving end. You choose to accept the job that's offered you. And the job that you're offered is something that is contributing to the economic welfare of everyone else. When you exercise a right, you're not just doing as you please, you're engaging in an exercise of freedom that enables others to exercise that same kind of freedom. When you go to vote, you're doing something that in a way contributes to the workings of self-government that consists of none other than a plurality of individuals participating in this common exercise, where they're not obstructing one another, but rather making it possible for everyone to realize their political freedom. The same thing applies to an economy in which everyone is able to participate and participate at a level that allows them to have a decent standard of living with which they can exercise their other freedoms. So I think the job guarantee is crucial in allowing us to exercise this right to have an independent livelihood. It is not a matter of a handout. It's not a matter of welfare dependency. It is the exact opposite. And I think that is what makes it so politically powerful, as something that all aspirants to the so-called American dream will have to acknowledge, that it is something that can't be really refuted. It's something that really is basic to our common idea that you should be able to support yourself in a way that's going to allow our society as a whole to be one of self-supporting individuals contributing to one another's livelihood and the good of the nation. And that's what it does.
All right. Well, besides our false ending, I believe that's our time for today.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Professor Chernevan. And as always, Professor Winfield, it's been a great discussion. And we hope to hear more on the national stage about a federal job guarantee, especially coming into the future and further elections and so forth.
And I recommend that everyone read this book. I think it's a very powerful statement of something crucial to the future of our country.
Thank you, Richard, for your work, and thank you for inviting me to be part of this conversation.